Today's date is May the 30th, 2012. My name is Jonathan Gerland, and I'm with Mr. Kerry Modisette, and we're in Havard, and we're going to do an oral history today. We're at the History Center in the conference room here, and also with us is Richard Donovan, who will be assisting us to record some of these memories. And maybe to get started, we'll start with you, Mr. Modisette, and then go to Mr. Havard. Maybe just tell us when and where you were born, just to sort of get us going, and then we'll, if you'll do that, and then you do it, Mr. Havard, and then maybe we can start with some of your earliest memories growing up. Tell a little bit about your family, what your mother and father did, and that kind of thing. And we'll start with you, Mr. Modisette.
Well, I was born on what's called up on the river in a little place called Lambert's Chapel. And the old doctor that delivered me was killed in a car wreck not long afterwards. His name was Dr. Hancock. But I can tell you quite a few things about up on the river.
And when were you born?
December 14th,
1937.
What
did your father do?
My dad, like so many, went to the shipyards to work during the war. Came back and work was scarce, and he got a job with the Forest Service, and also keeping up the old game reserve fence that actually the County Lumber Company owned at that time.
What were your parents' names?
Charles and Bertie Modisette. She was a McGoy, my mother.
Okay. When you say the river, we're talking about the Neches River.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
From, I've always thought from Sarah and Crossroad to Aaron Grimes is, you know, going up the river. And that may be or may not be.
Okay. Mr. Havard, when and where were you born?
I was born in Lufkin, 1947, August 11th. I lived in Sarah community most of my life. Went to school in Espalla. My daddy was a welder. He worked construction. Mother was a housewife, and she stayed home, raised the kids while daddy was off working.
And what were your parents' names?
Mother was Gladys Day, and my daddy was Lester Havard, but they called him Havard Havard. They were Lester and Bester. They were twins. They worked together up until Bester got killed. And said there was only one job that they never worked together. And he was known as Havard Havard.
And there were and still are lots of Havards.
Oh, a lot of Havards.
In this part of the country. So that helped distinguish him, huh? Havard Havard?
Right. That's what most, like I said, most people didn't even know his first name.
Okay. Mr. Modisette, tell a little bit about, so did you live down around the shipyards your early life? You said
no,
did
sir.
Your father go down there and work?
He stayed and came in on weekends.
On weekends, okay. Did you have brothers and sisters?
Had two brothers and two sisters.
Where were you in there as far as?
I was the baby.
The baby, okay.
And I didn't make the World War II. But my sister, oldest sister, went to a nursing school and became RN. My brother finally wound up at Texas A&M. But he didn't get to go until the war was over. From 50 to 55, I guess. And 48, I'm sorry, I believe he graduated in 40 and 50.
Where did you go to school?
Went to school in Zavala from, anyway, class 55.
Class 55, okay. What's some of your earliest memories of growing up as a child?
We had a lot of hogs in the woods that ran wild. People did, and the Havard family that lived across the road from us was little Charlie Havard. I looked up to him like a second daddy, and later years preached his funeral. But he was 10 feet tall in my sight, and that's what I remember first, that things that he could do with hogs and with a net. And I really believe if he hadn't been just a tiny bit lazy, that there wouldn't been any fish in the river. And I'm saying that is kind of a pun, but there's some truth in it, too.
So you went fishing with him a lot?
Yes, sir.
Tell about that. How did you fish back then? What was the fishing trip?
Charlie had three nets. Two of them was illegal, one of them was legal. He said you couldn't catch them as fish in a legal net. He didn't believe you could. So he had one to show the game warden and two to get his fish.
And what made them legal and illegal?
Inch and a half was what he wanted to tie for himself. 3 inches, I believe, was the legal limit.
And that's the spacing?
Yes, sir, between the nets. And those things are, you know, precious to me. He took a little old 22 with shorts, and I told him one day about seeing an old deer on his pond dam, and told him what it looked like, how many points it had. It was a high horn deer. I remembered it real well. He said, "I'll get him." About 2 weeks, well, he called me down to his house. "I'm going to show you something." So he carried me out there and showed me the horns off that deer. And there was no mistaking, you know, because I described him. I had a real good look at the deer, so. He was that kind of person. He'd shoot shorts and that 22, and, you know, where everybody would, use high-powered rifles and things. Little Charlie didn't believe in that. He just 22 short.
You think he shot the deer daytime or night, Kerry?
Either one. It didn't matter for him. Whatever was necessary. I didn't ever think of Charlie as being an outlaw because he didn't sell anything. He just ate his own, you know, food that he...
So this would have been in the 40s, early 50s?
Yes, sir. Okay. During that time. And my dad worked fire tower. And he was worried about, you know, crossing the state, so he stopped outlaw hunting. And
now, you said he worked fire tower. What do you mean by that?
He was a Texas Forest Service tower man and whatever that position was, you know. They ran a tower.
Did he travel around a good bit through East Texas?
No, he was at Wolf Hill. You remember, Hill. Dick, that yeah. He was there.
Just lookout spotting for fire.
Yeah. Gun. My daddy thought a lot of Richard. He was, he always liked him. And you didn't know it, but if we'd be coon hunting or something, and he'd tell them old stories. He was wanting to get you tickled. He loved to see you. I'd watch daddy. He loved to tell stuff. And he knew some good ones, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Well, what were some of the stories? Now, this would be, I guess, from the 40s, telling stories of the past before that time, right? Would that be the time period?
Well, it was also, you know, it was post-prohibition times, was it not? But still a lot of old evidence of things that had gone on during the 30s, I suppose, the prohibition day. A lot of old stills all in the woods that you could find chopped up. But I don't know if I ought to call these people making that whiskey or not. But anyway, Charlie had a man that was his cousin, and he was afflicted. He was hurt, man, real close to me. I just like a brother. And maybe I can say things about him that, you know, that I wouldn't say if I didn't know him so good, you know. But he had to move a whiskey still with help this man that had a still up on behind Renfro Pasture. Was it Pine Island or something back in there? But he was going to move it down to the mouth of Shawnee Creek. And one of the things he told, he wouldn't tell my daddy for years and years. Daddy rebuked him when he finally told him that he wasn't that ignorant. But he had done told me and several old boys around over the country. It would take him a long time to tell it because it was funny. But he said they got the whiskey still loaded and had it in a boat, a Cypress boat. And so this man said it was an on it. And when they got through loading the steel, it had about that much of it inking all the water. It was loaded to the gills.
So you're talking in dialect then for the recording. Did you quite catch all that?
Okay. He was so serious about it. I believe the man told it till he believed it. Honest to God, I believe he believed that. But anyway, he said they siphoned them off a gallon apiece. These two men in a boat, and the man that owned the still was running the motor, and Albert, of course, was just a hand, hired hand, was helping him. So he said he got down where the rivers converge at the island back. I know you've been through there, but
at the mouth of Shawnee Creek.
No, he was heading. They was on their way to. There's a Pine Island or something that's where the still was. But they got word that the sheriff's department was going to, Henry Billingsley was going to chop it up the following Monday. So they had to get it out of there on Sunday. And that's what this took place, you know.
Now, was this been where Fort Terran was? The little island
they
there?
Had to pass Fort Terran.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they wouldn't have been going but about half a mile below Fort Terran. That's where they was going to move the still to.
But they started north of there.
Probably that little island thing that we're talking about.
But it's way up that river to where that still was. Mm-hmm. I've wondered lots of times. I said, man, they had 25 miles, wasn't it? Went around
at least,
the
yeah.
curves. And the...
Yeah.
But anyway, he said he got to the where the rivers converged back together, and the river was high, he said, and he was unfeeling his alcohol, and he started playing out there in that river. Got Alvin scared, and he said he got that old boat going round and around. He had that motor pulled all the way to the side, you know. And directly, Alvin realized he was digging a hole in the river. And he said, he said, I reached under and got in that jug. Then it hear me so bad, I laid down in the boat. Now, I thought, Alvin, you done drank so much, you lay down in the boat. But now, he swore that he was that afraid, you know. But anyway, he said he got on, he just kept going round and round to keep digging that hole with momentum. Now, I don't know if he was cutting threads in that river or what he was doing, but just going round and round and digging a hole, he said, directly looked up and went, ain't
15 foot of water.
15 foot to the top of the water. He said, I thought, yep. That river is about 25 foot.
So he's making a whirlpool there.
Uh-huh. Okay. And when that romp hits that water, he said it's gonna be all over. So he said he was so scared he was laying down in the boat. He said just about the time that I'm not gonna call this man's name, that he got to the about where he thought he was gonna hit the bottom, said he front old motor back the other way and started backing out. Come out just like he went in.
In reverse.
He reversed it and said when it got an ump of the water, said it jumped 25 foot. He said there was waves going out across that river bottom. It was a pretty good tale, but when he told my daddy said, Alvin, you have insulted my integrity. I am not that stupid. But
what size? I guess it'd be an outboard motor. What size?
Outboard motor. He said it was an 18 horse. That was also questionable because I don't believe I ever saw one that big until I was grown.
Right.
And so I think he had.
Be a Johnson or Evan Rude?
Johnson. What he said, 18 horse Johnson. Yeah, he told it to a lot of people, and we laughed about it a lot. So I told Richard, I said, that's the only thing that I know, and I can't document it because I didn't ever see the hole.
It'd be hard to see that hole.
Terry, I grew up hearing a story, and my mind is, I can't remember who it was, but the lightning struck something that he considered valuable, and he went out and crawled up on the fence post and said, "You old gray-headed so-and-so strike me and you strike a pine knot."
Mm.
And lightning struck a tree right there, right beside of him, like scared him dead. You ever hear that story before?
I don't believe it did. I don't believe it did. I wish I could tell you something.
It was one of those river folks in there. I can't remember who it was.
I don't believe it would have been Alvin. He was pretty. He feared God pretty much. Okay. But
tell a little bit more. You know, again, we were talking earlier about the younger generation not identifying with some of the old ways of life. Tell a little bit more about these fishing trips and just being out in outdoors more so than today's.
Well.
People are, especially the young ones.
The work situation is what I, you know, was referring to, or what you were talking about a while ago. But for example, the Flournoy boys, we called them. Morgan Flournoy had four boys, and all of the women seemed like that lived around that area thought Morgan was working those boys to death, and it surely he's going to kill all of them. But all those boys turned out good. And that's all they ever knew was hard work, you know. And somehow we've lost that vision. And when you leave that, you leave something that a kid needs to know. I'm not saying they need to work as hard as those Flournoy boys. But them good boys, there was something quality, you know, those days of work didn't hurt them. And I don't think any of them resented it, far as I know. I think Don is some kind of a school administrator, college president, maybe. Do you know that?
No, I don't.
Up in Ohio, and of course, Tom, you know, all those boys just was good. Don and Tom and Pete and all of them. One of them's a lawyer. Here in town. But then, you know, Maynard Cryer, he worked George and Calvin until I used to think it was unmerciful.
Who's that?
Over at Zavala, Mr. Maynard Cryer.
Maynard Cryer?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And he's got two boys that's mine and Richard's age. And that's all them boys knew was to work. And George came along, and he had two boys, and he worked them pretty hard. And those boys turned out good. It's something, though, and when you leave that it creates a deficit there between something that we need or it's something you don't learn. I don't know what it is. Can you explain that, Rich?
I can't accept responsibility.
Responsibility?
Yeah.
When?
Well, I grew up in a time when, about the time I grew up, all the people quit raising cotton, and I never had to pick cotton. And I remember all the older boys, that's what they did every year, was pick cotton. And they quit farming about that time, except just for their garden. And I never had to really work hard in the fields, like they're talking about.
Well, we did.
Yeah.
Daylight till dark, before daylight till after dark. Because it was a simple logic Bible phrase. Isle of mine's the devil's workshop, you know. I mean, that's not exactly Bible, but that's what the old timers would say. And it pretty well held to that. Then the war came on, and something, you know, after the war, it was always different. The people never did work like they did, like they had before.
Well, tell again, for our audience that doesn't know about this hard work, tell, you mentioned picking cotton and things like that, but tell what the hard work was.
Well, we just had a 50-acre field in the river bottom. And if we didn't take it from the grass would take it from us. Whether we were raising peanuts, corn, high gear, whatever, I don't think we raised much cotton after I was grown, but before I was grown, my brothers and sisters never ceased to remind me I did not pick any cotton either. But
did you cultivate all 50 acres?
Yeah. No, I'm sorry, 40 of it.
40.
40 was in the field, 10 at the house. And we had garden stuff up there, you know, to have.
So what was work in the field like? What was a season of work in the fields?
Daddy was at the shipyard, and he came in one weekend, and it was eating my brother and myself up. I wasn't really big enough to figure in, but he asked my brother, he said, if I went and got you a new tractor, he said, would you run it? He said, my brother said, I'll run it till the wheels fall off.
Was that Jimmy Sam?
That's the way he answered that. And pretty near did. And that, we worked that old tractor. But we
remember raised, what kind of tractor it was?
International Model B.
How many horsepower did it have?
I imagine about 28, 30. Don't you? Probably. I'm not even. And I don't know. I'm just guessing. Couldn't have been over that.
Yeah. Wouldn't have been over.
It may not have been that much.
Was it gasoline or diesel?
Gas.
Gas, okay. And so so how would you cultivate the soil? What type of implements did you use?
We had a two-blade tiller that we'd break it up on, but not every year. But what would that be called? Flat breaking. And then you can get by a few years without having to do it again, until the soil, I guess, would be the revival, you know.
But what did you plant, and when did you plant?
We had to watch the river because it got in our field. We had a late crop, and several times we had to replant because of backwater getting our field. But seems like to me, I never got out of the field until it was here about time for school to start again. Finally get laid by, you know, and get a week or two before.
Did school start later back then? Say late September?
You know, nowadays
it starts in late August. Mm-hmm. But I know in the old days it didn't start till about September 30th.
Yeah, I don't believe I'd have got a day if it'd been like that.
I think until after the cotton picking season was over. School didn't start. And was that the case during your time too?
Uh-huh.
Late school start.
I'm not quite as old as these. And school started the week after Labor Day when I was growing up, okay. And we always turned out around May the 16th, somewhere along there.
But the river road, you know, to me was made up of Havard people and. There was some Harris's, there was Grimes's, and
Gilcrease,
Cameron's. Some wonderful old people lived on that road. I go up through there now, and I get depressed because a lot of them, I preach their funerals, you know. And Weaver's, what we call Weaver Bend, that's part of the river road, see. And Charles Havard, that we call Pee-wee, and Berlin, if you could get those two guys over here, could really clarify some of this, because they know a lot of things about the river road.
They did a lot of logging too, didn't they? A
lot of logging, and
with cross cut.
Yeah.
Tell about again net fishing. Just describe how you would do that. You know, I don't know, does anybody use nets anymore? Is it mostly trot lines? Or
they use them.
Well, describe that, because I think most people don't know how you run nets.
Well, little Charlie Havard was what they called a high-water fisherman, and he only fished, you know, basically in the spring. And he had 18 to 20 feet nets. With like I said, he didn't really believe you could catch a mess fish in a legal net. So he had 2 inch and a half mesh, and But you could walk in the front of his. It's about 5.5 feet. And then they tapered, of course, down to a, you know, to a 18 to 20 foot net. It's a large net, you know. I remember one time he had 19 flatheads, op, we call them, that weighed a little better than 600 pounds. And that's just kind of an example.
The Opelousas cats, yeah.
I remember he brought them out and showed them to me.
So how would they, drag the net behind the boat?
Sometimes you'd have to dip the net under the boat. I'm sorry, the boat under the net, can I get that right? And you'd have to simply dip the boat under the net and then bail the boat out. The only way you could get them in there, when you had one that full. That's what they had to do that day. But
Jonathan, what they would do, they would string that net out downriver. They would affix the one end of it and then stretch it out, and then the fish would swim into it. They would go off and leave it.
See, Charlie had a pattern. When the river would be down low, he'd go down there and look. And he knew that a fish coming up the river in the spring changed sides every time it got to the curve. It won't make the curve. It goes straight across and then turns up the other side. Then when it gets up to the next curve, same thing. It always crosses the river and goes. It does not follow, you know, a pattern of like a trail. It won't do it. So he'd find a place where he knew that they would be traveling, and where he could trap them would usually be between maybe a stump and some kind of obstruction, you know, that caused that fish to have to go with the current and go around it just a little bit. And it, a lot of times he'd have a net set that you wouldn't believe what he caught in that. It'd be so, but to get that net like that, it was hard to set, you know, to get it exactly right.
So he would fix both ends of it.
Yeah, he had to make that anchor of that net just exactly right so that that
so he
mouth,
would anchor to a stump on one mm-hmm. side. What would he anchor on the other side? The side of the riverbank or a tree?
Well, he said a net ought to set itself. He said that when it's right and you get it right, it'll swing right in position. That was always his theory. And but now this helper, this Alvin that we was talking about that I thought so much of, loved him like a brother. He didn't like that business. He thought that Charlie was fanatic. And the main reason he did is because they had an old motor that you had to wind the cord up on. Didn't have a reverse, didn't have a neutral. You just crank that thing and then turn it, you know, if you wanted it to back up. Not only was it dangerous because it had that old open flywheel on top, but Alvin just, it was just more pulling than he wanted to do, so he'd cuss like a sailor now. And ain't no use in that meat anything I ever eat in my. But Charlie'd make, no, Alvin, take it back up the river. We're going to move it. So he'd make Alvin run that net straight across the river nearby, and he'd turn it loose. And if it was like he said, it'd set itself. And if
so
it come back.
The current was swinging it around.
Did it set the anchor, the tail end of it, Jonathan, shaped kind of like a funnel, and they'd anchor this tail end. And then you just had to anchor it, then the current would sweep it right into where he wanted to go.
And when he got it like he wanted, it was right in that trail where those flatheads.
How was the drifting end? What's on it? Floats or weights or what?
No, the weight of the net itself. I don't remember him having any weights on it. It just set perfectly. It had that huge old 5.5 foot first hoop or two, you know, was big net, you know.
To make his hoops out of white oak or what, Gary, you know?
White oak's what I think he used back then.
So it would just swing in with the current and sort of trap them against that bank?
Uh-huh.
And then you just
If it were what I call a second bank, a lot of times in a river you have two banks. And on some of his net sets, well, it did. It would just come right up against the bank, beautiful. And then other places, though, would be where he'd picked out when the river was low. And he'd have it in a kind of an entrapment, and it would really, really, really pay off, you know.
So, what would be a day of fishing? Starting off early in the morning?
Oh yeah, he'd be out there early, you know.
All day, or just get your catch and
no,
call it a day?
Not with just three nets. He usually used. It didn't take him that long. one time, you know, the game warden called him and told him he wanted to see his nets. And so he showed him the, 3-inch net and, let the game warden go on his way. And then he picked up his other two and got his fish. But,
and what kind of fish would he catch?
Mostly, flatheads. He said if you started catching white perch, you was real close. Crappie, we call them now, but back then they was all white perch. And might have been white perch. Were they, Dick?
They're synonymous. That's what we called them, white perch, and now they got to be crappie.
And there's even such a thing as a black crappie.
Yeah.
You, when you get into all that. But so you catch white perch in your nets, and you're real close. That means you're real close to where you want to be for the catfish.
He'd hardly ever catch buffalo and rough fish like that. And if somebody was catching that, he'd just kind of smile, you know.
What about sand bass? Do you ever catch any white bass or anything like that?
I don't
that?
Remember, but you mentioned a while ago a spoonbill. He caught some of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen one in years now.
Paddlefish, they call them, John. Yeah. They're almost extinct.
What about a carp? Were there many carp back then?
Yeah, I caught a lot of carp because I didn't know how to set a trap.
I'm not sure there was any striped bass back in the river at that time.
I didn't know of any.
I'd never heard of them when I were young.
Usually if somebody caught a bunch of buffalo, he'd say, you're on the wrong side of the river. But, you know, that was Charlie.
What about black bass? Were there any black bass?
I don't remember any, but there was some smallmouth bass in that river.
Smallmouth.
We'd catch some of those.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So what would he do with the fish? He'd get
he'd
a
sell them,
boatload of fish. And
But before they outlawed selling the op, you can't sell one anymore. It's a game fish, right? But, you know, that was in, wasn't that way in the 40s, 50s.
So did he clean them and sell them cleaned? Or was there buyers waiting for him each day? Or
I don't know where he took those fish, but he had a buyer somewhere. You know, it left
Carlene's. but so he would have taken them to a buyer
somewhere
on that day,
yeah.
Then, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, he sold his fish.
Sold his fish.
I see, Carrie's told me that Charlie was real secretive. He wouldn't let anybody go with him except Alvin to set that net. He didn't want them to see how he did it.
Or where it was at.
Well, I was going to ask you, too, was there much competition? Were there other, I haven't told you this, Mr. Donovan, but in some of the old Dallas Morning News newspapers I've, in the last few months, have found, this going back to like the 1890s even, but there was wars down there in that river, the same area you're talking about, of competing netmen. And people stealing their nets, cutting their nets, and they made the Dallas newspapers, you know, over 100 years ago.
Mama.
What, was there any of that going on during your day? Was there
I can't
any other?
I can't remember him having any problem with, except I asked Alvin, the hairlip boy that I was raised with. He had a toe sack of op on his shoulder and a big old op in his hand. And I said, how much that old op there weigh? I mean, he said, it ain't pound. I said, Alvin, he weigh 30 at least. No, it ain't pound. And I said, where'd you get them? In an hammer. I said, yeah, I kind of thought you did. He was right there by it, you know. And but he come to me and apologized. He said, well, he said, I'm sorry. He said, I smarted off to you the other day. He said, but he said, I told a man one time where my net was. Cost me earning my honors, he said. He said, when I went to get it, game warden was sitting on it. So anyway, that was the way they looked at it. They were very secretive. And I told Charlie, all I want you to leave me, Charlie, and you will, is your net set. Don't leave me, no. Don't need nothing you got, but just your net set. So about 2 or 3 years before he died, he said, Care, I was sure going to leave you that net set. I didn't know he ever heard me. But he said, that net set is gone with the river. The river's changed. He said, there's nothing there anymore. He said, I'll tell you where it was if you won't try it. But he said, there's nothing there anymore.
How much time did you spend on the river?
Every minute my daddy didn't keep me in that field. I loved it with all my heart. I just We were river rats in a way, weren't we, Dick? And we used telephones if we could.
For fishing.
For fishing, we used.
Remember, we're referring to a younger audience here, so they wouldn't know what you were talking about, probably, or some of them.
Well, it got to be popular, I guess, back in the 50s. I remember when the Korean War broke out, that a bunch of the boys were going to Korea, and we all went down there, kind of give them a farewell party, and took an old telephone down there.
A hand crank telephone. Uh-huh.
River was real low, and we took an old fella that was synonymous with the river, and I better not use his name, but he was like another daddy to me. I had a lot of, boy, I loved those old river rats and their ways of fishing.
It wouldn't hurt to tell who he was, Gary.
But I better not, Dick.
There's statute of limitations, but, you know.
But I know all of his family. I love them like my own, you know. But anyway.
So how would you do that? How would you work the telephone?
First thing we did to him was give him about a half pint of gin. Got him, you know, ready to go do it, and primed him. We had to prime him before we could get the telephone hooked up. And the old man had ingested so much of that gin, I guess, that he forgot to put the wires on. So when he threw them out, the whole thing went out in the river. We had to dive for the ignorant wires. And so we finally got the wires back, hooked them back up. But we filled up two or three tow sacks of fish, you know.
So you put the wires in the water.
Yeah, and don't step on one of them. I promise you, it hurts.
And then you just crank. And about how big a radius would it shock the fish up?
Well, there's about four or five of us swimming after the fish with dip nets, you know, and sometimes they'd have to show them to us. We couldn't see them as good as they could up on the bank. But one time, you know, we just have to send him out on a log somewhere to a place where that he could operate and we could, too.
Operate the telephone.
Because really he couldn't operate off the bank. It wouldn't hardly work. But if he could find him a log somewhere and go across each side, or, you know, the further you could get your wires apart, the more coverage you have. And so the wires, that's why I said it was about 20 feet long. And naturally, when he threw both of them in the river, well, we'd lost our whole situation. But we got it back. We dived for the wires.
So it would shock between the ends of the wires. That area would shock.
It covers an area.
Fish.
Yeah,
were
probably
in there.
30, 40 feet.
We walked out on a big old log, or he did, and we was there to go pick up a bunch, you know. And some of them, a bunch of high-fin blues came out, the prettiest ones I hadn't seen any in years. And they just shot up through that drift and couldn't get back down. We just reached and picked them up.
And blue catfish?
Some of them went out on the bank, and they all must have been, you know, of the same school, because they were about 8 to 10 pounds. I mean, that was a sack full right there.
It will work only on catfish.
I'm sorry?
It will work only on catfish.
Only on catfish. And why is that?
I don't know. We ran a...
It won't work on scale fish.
We ran an old sucker out on the bank one time, but I never did know. He had two old whiskers, you know, that stuck out. I always wondered if it really was that or something else scared him. But I've had them hit me in the water, hit me on the leg.
What's that?
It has to be in running water. It won't work in a pond.
Won't work in a pond.
For some reason.
I don't know why.
For some reason.
Hmm. No.
And if you ever touch a fish,
he's gone.
He's gone. They'll lay up on top for several seconds, but if you touch him.
Paddles them or something, and whenever you touch them, they...
So you use a hand net or something to grab them.
Yeah,
okay. So we just temporarily shocked them, just disabled them for a little bit.
And it does not sterilize them, because they use them to raise their brood fish up, you know, in the hatcheries some way. There was a story come out one time that it sterilized the fish, but that's not true.
Nah. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Well, I think the Parks and Wildlife does some kind of electroshock now. That's how they do the surveys. They survey the lakes and stuff. And,
So you know it wouldn't hurt it.
Here's your cup. And here's another bottle if you need it. Mr. Monticet taking a little break. Mr. Havard, you care to add anything or some of your memories of, did you spend much time on the river?
We was about, I guess, 2 miles from the river. And we would go as often as we could. Of course, when I was a kid, there was no paved roads. Everything was still sand in the summertime.
My nose long like Pinocchio's. I don't want the line, was it?
you need Kleenex or something?
No. I don't know why I started coughing. That's why I said if my nose grew out like Pinocchio's, well, I guess I was a lion. But
in the summertime, we always had cousins everywhere living close around. We would get up as soon as we ate something, we'd go start playing, doing whatever we was going to do. The old roads were so hot in the summertime, you had to turn your feet sideways to cross them because the sand was so hot. We'd go hog hunting. Of course, the hogs was armadillos. We'd go catch armadillos and we'd chop the tails off and mark them just like the grown-ups did their hogs, and we had hogs running all over the woods.
But they were armadillos.
But they were armadillos, yeah.
Back, they were hogs.
Yeah, that was our hogs.
Hoover hog.
Yeah.
Hoover hogs.
You know, kids nowadays don't know how to play and have fun. If they can't be doing something with their fingers on a computer or Xbox or something, we used to go take pine saplings. And take three of us to pull them over. One would get on top, and we'd let it go.
Catapult you.
Yeah, I mean, that was how we had fun. An old stray dog come around. You'd put clothespins on its ears and get you a can and put rocks in it and tie it on its tail and send him home. And then the neighbors would get mad and come back and say something to your parents.
That's Sarah's rough place. Yeah.
Lambert Chapel was more genteel.
Yeah, we were docile.
It was more genteel.
Oh, yeah. But we did have a flying jenny at the family reunion every year. That was, you know, talking about having fun. There's nothing like a flying jenny. It was to take a big old log of a pole, you know, and cut a stump, and put that thing on top of it, mount it, and either pin it or I don't know how it was fastened, to be honest with you. But I know one thing, you could sure get knocked in the head on that thing. I'd get hurt on it. But we had a time, yes, I tell you. But, you know, kids had to go and do something. And we didn't have any toys or, you know, any playthings at family reunions and get-togethers. So we rode that flying jenny. That was the talk of the town.
Both. Now tell what that is.
A flying jenny?
Yes, sir.
Pole about 30 foot, well, I remember 30, 40 foot long. That, it's, you know, you have your stump in the middle and you fasten it where it'll swivel. Where the flying jenny will go around like a merry-go-round. But it's nothing but a pole. You get about 10 kids on each end of that thing running with it, you know. If somebody don't get knocked in the head, though, it's a miracle, I'll tell you.
Since the rest of the evenings, everybody, the neighbors, would visit. And something you don't see nowadays, a kid wouldn't know what it was, a bouncing board. All it was a plank, maybe 10 feet long, over a block of wood laying down.
Stick a stove with.
And you'd get on it and bounce. One of them would stand up on the end. Somebody would come jump on this end, and they'd go five or six feet in the air sometimes.
You take a hook and paddle, you know. I've run one 100,000 miles, I think. But
he didn't know what you just said.
A hook and paddle.
Rolling a hoop?
You take a hoop and take a PA can back then, you know. And you bend it up to where it... your hook won't be so hard to hold. And the axe handle, you don't put that tobacco can on that axe handle. Just roll that old hook. And rolled it up a dirt
roll. You nail the can in the bottom of the axe handle. And you take your hoop then, your can's been around, and roll it down the road.
But this fella...
Run along beside it and
yeah.
just roll it around. Okay.
This fella that, you know, when progress began to be made and scientific progress, I guess you'd say, televisions came out, is what I'm trying to say. Well, Daniel Boone was on a certain time of the week. And Daniel Boone would throw that a hatchet or axe? And he'd split that log. You know.
It was his Indian friend.
Yeah. One of them would throw an axe. But this fellow said, I don't believe me hitting that log every night.
What's that?
He thought he was having to do that every night. He didn't realize it was a repetition. You know. He said, I don't believe me hitting that log every night. So he sat there and waited for him to miss that log. That's when he finally come up with the idea, I don't believe he can do it. And he can't throw one that many times without missing.
And I'm sure somewhere on TV he's still doing it. They're probably yep. playing it somewhere.
Oh, man. But like he didn't ever believe they went to the moon, you know. There was just no way. He said they lit up on some mountain, took him pictures. In his idea, in his heart, in his mind, he never did believe it either.
Now, who's that again? Who are we talking about?
This fellow I was talking about a while ago. He was like my brother there, but he didn't, you know.
Is that the Havard?
Yeah.
Charlie Havard?
Charlie's a cousin.
Charlie's cousin.
Yeah, Charlie's cousin, Alvin.
Alvin.
Okay. Yeah, he was a great guy. He just didn't believe they went to the moon. That was that simple.
Did he have how long was it before he had a television carrying?
I don't know. Wrestling was the mainstay when it first came in. Everybody would go to somebody's house on Friday night to watch wrestling. And then Charlie got one. And that's when Alvin started watching Daniel Boone. And that's when he said that about the, I don't maybe in that all governor.
Around 57, 58?
Then before then, when it went. See, I was already in Germany in 57. But
we got our first one in 56.
Early 50s, I guess. But that's just little old things, you know, that was funny, but it was life, you know. So
what did everybody think about this TV? First time you got a TV, first time you saw a television. What was that like? Do you remember the first time you saw one?
Well, you know, it was...
Was it somebody's home or in a store in Lufkin, or...?
They received it better than they did the telephone. Now, when the telephone first came in, of course, I wasn't born, but it was in the 30s. I'm a 37 model. It was the early 30s that they strung that wire, you know, and a bunch of them Havard boys didn't believe they could talk over a wire. And I'm not going to repeat their language, but... They said, ain't nobody talk over a wire, you know. So anyway, one of them, the operator hooked up the phone. I'm not the operator, but whoever hooked the phone up at the house told him, you know, to ring that old thing. And so the operator answered. So this Havard boy said, who are you? He said, I'm operator. What number you want? He said, you ain't operator. He said, you Steve around behind the house. And he told him to go to the bad place, you know. Oh, man. Stuff like that, it really happened, you know. It just, people, they wouldn't have that.
Just couldn't believe it, huh?
Uh-uh. But now, I don't remember anything like that about the television, because the radio had already preceded it, you know, and pretty well.
So it was just the radio with pictures now.
Yeah, radio with pictures. It was pretty well received, you know.
Jonathan, you've got to keep in mind, you've got to put this in perspective now. He's talking about a place that today is one of their most remote places in Angelina County, for
mm-hmm.
sure. And back in those days, it was even more remote than that.
When they brought the electricity, that was after you and I was in high school, friend. TPNL brought it line to Saron. And REA brought it around, you know, to Davis. So REA bunch was hooking Jack Havard's, you know, went to his house. He said, how much is it? They said, it's a flat rate of a dollar and a half a month if you don't use but X amount of kilowatts, you know. So he got his pencil out. He cussed. He said, "That's a nickel a day." He said, "The highway robbery. I won't pay it."
Nowadays, you spend that every time you turn the light switch on, just turning it on.
But now he flat said that. I mean, I could document that pretty well if I could bring some of those people back.
A nickel a day, huh?
He said, "That a highway robber." He said, "That a nickel a day. I won't pay it." And he didn't. And he told all the people from REA, said, "You might as well not bring that down here. These people won't pay their bill." But they did.
You get addicted to it.
See, I guess Sarum was a little more remote than up on the river, because Gary was saying they had phones up there in the 30s. Well, it was 1957 before we got phones in Sarum. And Brian Bird was the main reason we got phones.
Tax assessor collector. He was tax assessor collector.
Brian was at that time?
I don't remember.
It was... And we didn't have bathrooms until probably 58 or 59. We had an old outhouse. Didn't have running water. Well, my grandpa dug a well. And we finally run a line from his house to our house, and we had running water. I mean, we... When I was a kid...
Captured it off the roof before that...
Yeah, had a cistern that most everybody in the community had a cistern before they started digging wells.
Did the cisterns ever go dry like this drought we had last summer when we didn't get rain for 2 or 3 months?
If we had had a drought like this.
What'd y'all do if your cistern ran out?
Had to haul water from some branch or?
There was spring.
Clean out a spring somewhere. We had to do that a lot. Clean out old spring branches, you know, where the springs were, and let it settle and start, you know, when it would be a dry year or something, haul our water. We had a well that went dry, and so I guess that was a water table dropping in. We didn't realize what it was.
Tell about hunting a little bit. We talked a little bit about fishing and you'd mentioned, you know,
We hunted deer with dogs and everything with dogs. Squirrels with dogs. We had hunting dogs mostly. And
how prized was a good hunting dog?
Well, enough that you didn't want to loan him to anybody because he'd mess him up. It wasn't that they minded you borrowing a dog, but they was real strict about the fact that you might break him from some of his habits, you know.
Confusing.
Mm-hmm. And boy, they didn't like that at all. And I didn't blame them. You know, I didn't want to loan mine either. But I deer hunted most of the time with dogs. And we wanted fast dogs, something that could smoke them. And, you know, get people that could kill them if they come by came out by them. We'd put standards out. And from the time I was big enough to, we'd get set on car fenders, and there was hardly any deer in this country. That's surprising to a lot of people. But Daddy killed his first deer when I was a big old boy, 12, 14 years old. And there just wasn't any deer. We'd get on a car fender and ride for miles trying to find a fresh track, put the dog out on it, and if he could smoke it or, you know, jump the deer. Well, we'd run, get on stands if it was where we could, you know.
What type of rifle or shotgun would you use?
Most of them I use shotguns.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Buckshot?
Oh, yeah, double-aught buckshot usually was the mainstay.
Mostly 12-gauge. There was a few 20-gauges.
Mm-hmm.
16-gauge never did catch on around here.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a little competition between the dogs. I know Carrie's daddy had a dog named Old Bozo. My daddy had a dog named Candy. And they were probably pretty equal. And they were both one of the best deer dogs in the country. And opening morning, I've seen cars a half mile long at our house. People come from everywhere to go hunting on opening morning. Well...
His dad, if he had had something to go into infamy about, it would have been... a deer hunter, because he loved to hunt with dogs, you know.
Well, what type of, what breeds of dogs?
Old Candy was a little pencil tail red bone out of Louisiana. Now, don't ask me what a pencil tail red bone is. She wasn't a big dog. She was a small dog. She didn't have long ears. But you could see the red bone in her, and she had a small tail. I guess that's where they call them pencil tail.
Mm-hmm. Bozo was black tan.
Black what?
Black and tan. And
tan?
Yes,
black and tan.
Most of the breed of a dog, black and tan.
Oh, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. They make real good coon
Most
dogs.
Of them are slow, though. And we looked for one that had a little cur dog in him that'd be faster. And it usually made a better, and they didn't run as long. But
would you use the same dogs for deer as you would squirrels? Or?
We could on Bozo, but very few that we ever had, you know, we could do that on.
What about coons? Was there much coon hunting?
Oh, all the time. There was so many coons when my daddy was talking about that tractor a while ago that the first year we raised corn in that river bottom, we killed 160-something that we wouldn't even count them if we didn't kill them out of the corn patch.
Out of the corn field.
And I mean, that would tell you something. 160 coons would demolish them. They would come from as far as Sarin, which was 4 or 5 miles, because we'd run a lot of them down to Sarin from the patch. The dog would get after them.
Hmm.
And that's how far they'd come to eat that corn.
What you tell him about those fast dogs your dad had?
Slim Palmer, my neighbor, was another hero of mine. And he didn't believe in hounds. He liked little fast. And he had a stock of dogs that he got from S.C. Mitchell.
Now, spell that, feist?
Yeah, F-I-E-S-T. Correct me if I'm wrong.
E-S-T. I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, terrier. It's a terrier type.
Terrier dog, okay. Mm-hmm.
But that Slim was our next door neighbor. He lived about 3 or 4 miles away. But he had those dogs, and it made Daddy so mad because they would tree coons, and they could win them. That Daddy's black and tans had the trail on the ground. Well, it was just like a air compressor going along the dust. It'd be so dry in the summertime, and those poor old hounds just couldn't smell. About that time, that feist a tree.
Because he could smell it in
the wind. He'd wind it, you know.
Smell it in the wind, okay.
And Slim would say, "There he is." And that was just like pouring hot water on Daddy's back. Because he was usually there, too. Oh, we laughed about that. Me and Dick was talking about how Daddy was so... He had some of the best coon dogs in the world. Everybody knew that. But, I mean, each dog has a... advantage, you know, that feist can work a hound to death under situations like that.
We were at their house one night, 2 or 3 of us boys went in there to hunt with them, and we kind of, this first time I'd ever seen a feist coon dog, and we kind of ridiculed his dad, you know, a little bit about that those little dogs couldn't kill a coon, and so we kept on it. About the last one we treed that night, well, he said, "Okay," he says, we'll have a demonstration. I don't remember just what he said. But anyway, we got that coon out, and those little old dogs killed that coon just like that.
They knew just exactly how to fight them. They had their little place. One of them would try to catch him right on top of the head, and they would throw him. Now, that's the same way Charlie and Alvin would do with a hog. Alvin would throw his loop down behind the hog. And Charlie would always be at the front. He'd throw his, as soon as he saw that loop, he'd back that hog up by going towards him a little bit. And when the old hog backed up into that loop, well, Alvin would jerk it. And then Charlie, he was so good with the rope, he'd rope his nose or head, you know. And one would go one way, and one would go the other. They'd pop that hog just like clockwork, you know. And those little old dogs had the same practice with a coon. They'd have that coon stretched out, and you couldn't nothing he could do about it. Want to come in there and get him right by the throat. Bye.
And it didn't take him long to do it.
It didn't take long to do it.
I think that coon would tear him all to pieces, but he didn't.
But now he got that stock of dogs, if I'm not crazy, from Sturman Mitchell. Had a Studebaker place there and left. S.C. Mitchell.
Now, Mr. Havard, you mentioned as kids y'all used to mark
the ears and tails maybe of armadillos doing what you saw the your parents' generation doing, you know, with the
hogs. Everybody had a mark on their hog. So yeah.
That's what I was going to ask you, Mr. Moss, you mentioned earlier, you know, early on that wild hogs ran in the woods. I was going to ask you, did everybody have their marks, and how did you round up the hogs and know whose was who? Did you trap them, or?
You had to depend on, you know, your neighbor
was
being
that,
honest.
There
was no other route. And most of them were.
Because you couldn't tell unless you had the hog in hand whose mark it was, right?
I didn't say all of them were honest, you know. Most of them were, thank the Lord.
But, did everybody know everybody's mark?
Yes, sir. And could spot it. It could as fast as they could. That's so and so's hog.
What was your family's mark?
I don't remember. I was sitting here trying to think. It was a crop and a swallow fork and a underbit and a and a let was it in the left ear? It was what all did they have? The split, the swallow fork, the crop,
underbit, overbit,
I can't remember all those marks. But
in 1879, the state of Texas passed a log brand law. And they chopped or gouged with an axe the logs that were floated. That was in the days before the railroads came up here. Mm-hmm. And they were doing most of the log floating down the Neches.
Right.
And I think, if I remember right, the first year they enacted that law was 1879. And there were over 94 different marks registered in the Jefferson County Courthouse. That's Beaumont.
Mm-hmm.
But that gives you just an indication as to how many. But it was just the same thing, you know, the ownership of the logs. Because you'd cut them out in the woods and you'd drop them in the river and you'd float them down. And the neat thing about Beaumont is there were four big sawmills there.
Right.
And they were all interrelated by marriage. There were four daughters of a prominent lumberman, and all the big lumber companies came out of the sons that married this man's daughters.
Hmm.
But they had an honor code, you might say. As these logs would float down, and each mill, you know, they didn't bother sorting them out. They just took whatever logs mm-hmm. were convenient to them
mm-hmm.
and took them up. But then they would have somebody there that would register the mark, you know, the chop or the gouge, which is kind of interesting because that's mm-hmm. the same principle.
That's amazing.
Of doing that. And, of course, when the railroads came in, that kind of did away
with
the river floating. And you know, again, this
speaking
is
of being
many years
honest,
ago.
There's an old cousin of mine rented our house one time down there, and so I was already grown. But that's been several years ago. So I went around the smokehouse and looking around, and I seen an old .22 up there. And the guy was out there. I said, "Whose gun is that?" He told me so and so. He said, "Do you want it?" He said, "I'll give it to you." He said it belonged to a certain fellow that he knew, that everybody knew. I said, "Yeah, I'll take it." It was an old .22 that you had to pull the little deal back on the back of it to shoot it. So I went a few days later and told my grandpa, I said, "Papa, this is Marvin, give me this gun." He said it belonged to so-and-so. He looked at that gun. He said, "That gun has probably stole a lot of my hogs." So that's they were certain people known that you had to watch, and certain ones that they knew was honest. So I told the guy's grandson years later, I said, "I've got this gun, and I'm going to give it to you. It belonged to your grandpa."
Charlie saved my life. He didn't know how he did it, but he always told me, so now, most hogs doesn't really want to attack you. He said they'll run right up to you, and then they'll either stop or they'll turn. But he said every now and then, one will get you if he can, you know. So me and Daddy was getting the hogs out of that pasture I was telling you about. It was belonged to Angelina County Lumber Company. It was in the They planted pine seedlings in there, so hogs was getting pretty bad in there. We was having to get them out. So we chased one day until he decided he wasn't going to run no more. And I had an old pine knot in my hand that I'd found. I liked it because it's pretty. It looked like a little baseball bat, but it was short, about like that solid pine bow. And I was just kind of use it because we was in some of those old high hills over there. And when we finally baited that hog again, that hog had all he wanted. And the dog was not a catch dog, so he didn't have anything to offer. So he run at me. And I thought about what Charlie said, though. He said, if one ever gets close to you, he said, don't move. He said, wait till he gets, right at you. He said, a hog can't turn quick. They're stiff-bodied. And I never knew that, you know. And he said, he can't just turn like a dog or something can. And said, he'll have to run by you because he can't turn around. If you wait till the last minute, then jump out of his way. And he'll cut at you with his tush, you know, on one side. But when he come by, that old hog was, he had blood in his eyeball. I hit that thing between the eyes with everything I had. I jumped sideways, just like Charlie said, and I played it to the hill and hit him just like he was a baseball right between his eyes. Killed that old big hog. He weighed about 300 pounds, you know, and he was something. And I didn't know my daddy was watching that he was over across the canyon over there. I said, he come over and said, boy, you're a dangerous man.
I think so too.
No, I said, I'm not dangerous. I said, that thing meant to get me. He said, he sure did. Said, he was after you. But
speaking of hunting, my daddy was notorious for hunting. And he died at it. I didn't know what beef was till I was half grown. We was raised on venison and biscuits. That's mother cooked biscuits three times a day, and we had venison probably twice a day. But every year, the first morning of deer season, he'd usually have a buck hanging up in a tree that he had killed the night before.
Let me interrupt you. Just that deer season didn't mean a whole lot, though.
No. I mean,
that's just when they did it openly.
People killed deer to eat. They wasn't worried about the horns or anything. They fed their family with them. It's like going to the river catching fish. And to them, they knew they was breaking the law, but it wasn't breaking the law to them. And everybody did it.
It was a way of life.
Sure. I started hunting. Oh, I guess I was 6 years old when I started hunting. And Daddy wouldn't let me hunt on Sunday. He said, you can hunt anytime you want to, but you're not going to hunt on Sunday. And he wasn't a man that went to church, but he respected the church that
much. Some things come down through, you know.
Yeah.
Handed down.
Yeah.
That's one of them. That's the way my folks were.
How many hogs did y'all kill a year?
We didn't have hogs in the woods. Daddy never did. Now, all the rest of the community had hogs.
Seems like I remember in the fall, you know, on the first big cold snap, you know, was one that took place. And four or five old big hogs, you know, would be about what we'd butcher. And that pretty well take us through the winter, I guess. I don't really remember cranking that old. I was glad. I didn't like hog killing. But that's a lot of hard work, man.
Describe it.
Well, you gotta get your, we had a big old wash pot, you know, we'd heat that water to boil and, you know, and we had an old, barrel that was set in the ground at an angle. And, you know, for a kid that, when he doesn't weigh but about 110 pounds back then, you know, well, having to grab a half of a hog and put him in that old barrel, in other words, we'd heat the water, put it in the barrel and scalding hot and set that and try to get that hog in there and out without setting the hair on it.
Yeah, you couldn't get your water too hot because it set the hair on the hog. That's what they claim.
You couldn't get it on. But if you had your water just right. And that took some doings, man. So two people, you know, grab the little hog by the front and left and back legs, you know, and in that barrel you'd go. And then you'd turn him around and put him in head first and let that head stay in there a little bit longer than that other did. And pull him out and out on a place that they had, you know, usually boards or something. But it was had to be a pretty clean place. But anyway, that's when the big butcher knives came out, and you scrape that hair off at home.
And if you had some hair that wouldn't come off, you put a tow sack over it, get some hot water.
Yeah.
And put on there. And
heat it again.
Heat it again and make that hair come off.
So you kept the water hot in your wash pot. And that's a pretty good deal. One thing about it, it was felt good because that was warm, that old heat around that far. I'll never forget that, boy.
So how long would it take to finish a hog out?
I'd take a...
From getting... Starting your morning or your day, whatever, you start with the water, get building your fire.
Well, if you had four or five to kill, you figure on half a day, you know, at the very least.
Good half a day.
Yeah. And that was those bragging guys that told how fast they could scrape one, you know. But you got to hang that thing up then, and if you've got four of them, well, then you've got to, first thing you do is hang them up by the back feet and gut them. And that takes some precision, man, that they would never let me do. And my dad wanted that part of it because he didn't want to cut into an intestine, you know. But lots of times if the weather was not as cold as we thought it was going to be or something, they'd swell, you know. And, boy, you really had to be careful then.
Had to get that smoke and that salt on them pretty quick because they
wanted
to run.
Put that salt on there until you'd think they'd surely ruin that meat. But they didn't.
And the first thing a lot of them would do was split their head open and get the brains, take them in the house, and they'd have brains and...
Eggs.
Eggs and brains.
Not me.
I didn't like them either. And chitlins.
Where did you get your salt?
They'd buy it in the... 100 pounds? Was it 100 or 50?
50, I think, Kerry. That's the way it was at Tisdale's when I worked there.
I remember several bags of it, you know, we'd always buy. And, man, oh man.
But there wasn't anything better than going in the smokehouse and smelling that smoked meat. Oh, I can still smell that. Going to take your knife, cut your strip off, chew on it half a day.
Either one of you have a potato house?
We had a...
No.
We had a potato house, and it was... really, I didn't understand it too much as to what the deal was, but I guess the coop, it was built low for some reason. It was always a low-lying building, and...
Was it dug into a bank a little
bit? Dug into a bank if you had one, and if not, you throw dirt around the sides of it. Had lots of ways that... did you mention to John about the Tejas Indians paying with gold? Did y'all ever discuss that with you? We got into that the other day, but you might not want it with this. I didn't know. But it was always told to me that the Tejas Indians had gold that they paid. They bought with gold. And I had talked to a geologist about that old lead mine down below Shawnee Creek. And that geologist said where there was lead, there was gold. A little. At least a little, I believe the way he said it. There would be some gold with any lead mine. He said you could look for a measure of gold to be there, which it might have been more than one lead mine that the Indians knew about that we didn't know anything about. But was that not them that was killed? See, when they would lay their corn by in the summer, they would go to High Island or places like that on the coast and spend summer and come back in the fall. And there was people that knew and heard about their gold that waylaid them, killed a bunch of them. And I never did know, somewhere down around, was it Saratoga? I don't know.
Seems like it.
Where they was waylaid, they waylaid a bunch of them and got their gold. because they was peaceable Indians, you know, they didn't bother nobody, from what I heard. So I didn't know if you had that in mind or not. Did you ever study that, or?
Well, not that particular one, but I've looked at some of that.
That was just stuff I heard when I was a kid, you know. But
did talk a little bit more about your father. You said he was a fire tower man. He worked for the Texas Forest Service. But did I understand you to say that he was somehow connected with a game preserve, or did I misunderstand you?
Actually, the Columbia Company had 10,000 acres fenced off that they made a game preserve out of. And it went almost to Zavala. Went over to the Poland place. I remember going over there. And then it back over to where we lived, up the river road. And so we would start on Saturday, or I would. That's what I learned to hate a horse. Get out and have to ride that thing. Took all day to go around. And any gate that was, you know, blown out by the water or flood or whatever, you'd have to reset it. And the fence
was... So with barbed wire?
Uh-huh. Patch the fence if it got broke, a limb fell on it, tree fell on it. And so you had to carry some tools with you. And it was a rough ride. Boy, by the time I got grown, I wouldn't have had a horse if they'd been 5 cents apiece. I wouldn't have bought one.
So your dad worked for Angeline County Lumber Company? Doing that?
Yes, he did, because that was a side part-time job. He worked actually for Texas Forest Service.
Did you know Bill Wright?
Oh, yeah. Knew him like a... He sat at our house the first time that Russell come over there. Well, we didn't know if he... You know, he was a game warden, all right, but he was a game biologist and a whole lot different from what we thought. He became a real close friend of ours. But... Daddy was telling him about killing a little old deer with... And my grandmother sitting up there, she didn't know anything about the game laws. I don't get... She said, Charles, is that little old deer with horns about that long? Daddy turned red as a beet. But yeah, we loved old Bill. And he turned out to be a close friend of ours.
So would your dad have been a pasture rider? Would that have been a name, or?
He made his son ride that ignorant pasture.
Okay.
And burned him out completely on it.
But not a pasture rider in the sense of trying to catch people.
Oh,
up.
No, no. Okay. Just keeping the fence.
Just checking the fence.
And the hogs out.
Okay. Because I know some of Temple's pastures, their pasture riders, and I'm talking in the 20s now, you know, did all of it, you know. Maintain the fences.
No, their danger would have been I'd have killed a bunch of those deer.
Yeah, keep the fences up, keep people out. And of course, there were still, like Charlie Harbor, I mentioned, you know, his family actually lived inside the fenced areas.
Uh-huh.
And then he had mentioned that at some point the company, Southern Pine Lumber Company, bought out, you know, basically just tried to relocate the people, get them off the land. But they paid them money for all their hog marks, you know, or basically just, you know, we'll pay you a certain amount of money. You just transfer all your marks to us and things like that. But he's told me stories about, you know, actually gunfights that they used to have over in Trinity County. Y'all ever hear about things like that in Angelina County? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Can you care to share anything of that? Or?
You, Wendy?
No.
I can't think of anything right now to be pertaining to the...
What about William Crane, Kerry?
I'm sorry?
William Crane.
William Crane. He was like my... He was a neighbor that you couldn't beat him. He was just people help one another. And he was one of the best for a neighbor. He didn't like us running deer with dogs. But, you know, we still got along. We didn't have any problems. I don't think he'd have killed a dog of mine if he'd have known it was mine, but he had been accused. I'm not sure he ever killed one. But, you know, that was some of those things you were talking about a while ago that gets into a war almost. But
I think the Rayville pasture used to be what's now South and North Boggy Slough.
Uh-huh.
And it was often told that the man who headed it, actually it was a cattle ranch that Temple ran out there. And it was told by more than one person that
he did not like dogs being in his cattle pasture. And he and all his men, you know, if you see a dog, you shoot him. Now, some of his men had dogs, cattle dogs. And, you know, he just didn't want deer hunting dogs getting in.
Well, they didn't understand. A lot of old timers thought if you take a couple of dogs to a place, every deer in there leave. That's the furthest thing from the truth. You could take a dog in there 50 times if there was 50 deer in there, and probably one of them would leave and all 49 would stay in there. We watched that coon hunt. You know, you could see them with a light. They'd lay there and watch a dog go right by them, never move. They wouldn't be 20 yards from them. And I realized that deer didn't look at things like we do.
Walker hound changed that a little bit, though. Walker hounds are different.
I used to tell them, I said, I'll promise you, if you'll make the same drive twice, you'll jump just as fast as you did the first time. Because those deer don't leave. You'll just get after another. We proved it over and over. And James Allen was telling one time about a big old deer they were after. They all wanted to kill him because they'd seen him, 11 point. And they realized that every time they'd start putting out the standards, and then whenever the dogs would jump, the dogs would come through the stand, but there wouldn't be a deer out there. Wouldn't be any deer. They thought the dogs was lying at first, you know. And then they realized that deer was smart enough that whenever they put those standards out, and he heard those car doors slam, he just eased out. And then when the dogs came through running, he'd been gone long, forgot about it, you know. So somebody went down one day and got ahead of, you know, where you usually cross, and killed him, I think, on the second. They heard him shoot on the second standard when they was putting him out. He done started easing out. He shot. They're very smart.
Do you remember the altercation with William Crane and David and Mrs. Crane there at the Shawnee Prairie Church?
No, I don't. I never did. I think I must have been in Germany. So
I was gone. The reason I was asking you about it.
Well, I was.
I heard about it when I came back in.
Because I can't remember any vivid recollection of anything like that, except I know what I've heard, what you said right there. Mm. Did you know anything about it?
Well, the only thing about it is they had accused, I think it was the Hamiltons, who I think it was, if I remember correctly, they accused William of killing their dog, which, you know, I don't doubt for a minute that he did, probably. And David had gone to a party in Zavala, and they had seen him or something, so they went back up at the church house and waited for him on his way home. But just luckily, William and his wife were worried about the same thing. So they came out, and David didn't even know they were behind him. But they were following David home. And so they had stopped David there at the church house and were fixing to,
Oh, it must have been down at Lambert Chapel Church then.
I was thinking it was at the Shawnee.
Was it Shawnee Prayer?
I think the Shawnee Prayer Church, what I was thinking about. But anyway, they were about to accost him, and Mr. and Ms. Crane came up. And it wound up, she hit one of the boys. They were after William and David, but she interfered. She had a very big pair of pliers or a crescent wrench or something, and she hit one of the boys on the hand. But there were charges filed and everything.
Something over the same deal happened. I think William and Chuck Kirkland got into it one time. The best I remember. Now, I can't remember the details.
Bless his heart, he had a lot of trouble, I know that, with hunters.
Yeah.
People just ran roughshod over his pasture, I know that.
Yeah, it was uncalled for. Really on both sides, if they could have.
Oh, yeah.
If they could have just talked.
I've known people, it would thrill them. You could drive by Mr. Crane's house about any time and see deer out there. I mean, just, he had a lot of deer. And some of these old outlaw boys, the younger ones, it would just thrill them to drive by there and shoot one within sight of his house and just leave it laying there. I mean, now it's just sorry. But I've I've known some of them that would do it.
I was going to ask you a little bit about property ownership and access to the woods, access to the river and things like that. Do you care to comment on anything specifically, especially as it relates to today? I know, you know, we've looked at issues of river access. You know, where can you put a boat in, and where can you do this, where can you do that? And there's just not very many places, you know. It's and I know from your experiences, you know, just what I've heard today, you know, there were more people out and about and doing things like that. So how did that work back then?
The only thing that comes to my mind is that W.T. Carter, that was the primary owner of the timberland in that area at that time, with the exception of that 10,000 acres that Angeli County Lumber Company, that they had a lot of squatters. People had squatted on the land, and they had a large court case in Livingston at the county seat of Polk County. I guess Camden probably the reason. Is Camden in Polk County? And they actually had Percy Foreman, one of the lawyers of lawyers, I guess, of the 30s and 40s, 50s, somewhere. I guess he's in the 50s. And they got a lot of that land back. They didn't get all of it back, but, you know, pretty well where people were living, I think they may have let them keep living. But the way they settled the case, I thought was unique. They took pieces of timber, took them to the courtroom, and they peeled that hull back on that. You couldn't see it from the outside, but maybe you could barely see it, and I don't know. But what they told was that in the courtroom, they would take one of those deals and haul that bark off that pine, and there would be that old scar, and it would mark W.T. Carter's, you know. So they gained a lot of their... I always thought that was neat, the way that they presented that case with that evidence of those timbered pieces, you know, still having the marks on the line of the witness trees. Witness trees, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know back, even the 20s on, you know, I was telling you about Charlie Harbor, you know, that, you know, these lumber companies, as that evolved, I think, you know, they bought the land, they bought the timber, and there were people already living on it. And, you know, as time went on, what a lot of the big lumber companies tried to do was have these acknowledgement of tenancy records. And it was actually a legal document that they would get the families, because the lumber companies wanted to keep the peace, too.
Yeah, they were trying hard to get along, looked to me like.
So they would, you know, basically approach a family and say, okay, we're acknowledging that you're living here, and you can live here as long as your elder generation, or, you know, whatever they could work at. It might be one generation, two generations, or whatever. And you know, you can continue to live here. Here's what you can do. Here's what you can't do. But you're acknowledging that you don't own anything. Mm-hmm. We're just letting you, and it would be a binding legal document. And so basically they could exist or continue to exist the way they pretty much had. Mm-hmm. But from the lumber company's interest, their main thing was on paper, so that some point in the future they won't have those claims, because these people already are signing documents saying we acknowledge that we don't own this. And we're just being allowed to live here and continue to, in some cases, maybe hunt. You know, and I mentioned, you know, Charlie Harbor talked about it. Eventually, the companies would buy out, you know, the hog marks and, you know, whatever else, and phase that out. So I think that was kind of an interesting part of history. But tell me, you know, both of you, I guess, you know, about 10 years apart, but, you know, y'all had access to the river and, you know, did your hunting and your fishing. Where would you, you know, today, if we were going to do something like that, we're pretty limited to where we could put a boat in the river. Where would y'all do that?
At that time in the 30s and 40s, we had access, but the first thing I remember that began to be trouble was Charles Wilson met up, I don't know how many times he was running for office at the time. He was Temple's...
About the congressman.
Mm-hmm. Became a congressman. Yeah, but he was state representative then.
Right, okay.
But he saw what was going on. And he come and told us, he said, y'all are sitting around and letting all of this come, just close in around you. It's going to squeeze you plumb out. He said, what you going to do? He said, if you don't watch it, he said, they're going to lease these places. You're not going to have a place to hunt. And then before they do that, they'll probably stop dogs from running. Everything old boy said was true as true could be. And it eat us up. And everybody said, well, what can we do? You know, we just kept hunting. But every year we'd lose a little ground, until finally no place to hunt and no dogs to run. And they enforced it. So once I didn't have a dog, I quit. I haven't hunted since. I haven't killed a deer in 50 years. I don't know.
So where would you put the boat? Where would you put your boats in?
Oh, we had places along the river that belonged to W.T. Carter that they didn't care.
They didn't care. Okay.
So we would go like...
Just kind of community spots.
Right.
Where y'all would, you know, wasn't a state-maintained boat ramp or anything.
No,
just places that were good to...
About three or four places at Sarwan, and then between Sarwan and Lambert Chapel up there, three or four places, and then between Lambert Chapel and Weaver Bend, three or four places, and it was like that all the way up the river.
Nobody... enforced any type of ownership or restrictions?
No.
Or, hey, this is my property, get off.
Well, it belonged to the lumber companies.
But see, W.T. Carter sold out. And then when they did, well, the other companies, you know, started leasing the land. And then it's just a matter of time.
And
you couldn't
have
hunt
a,
here.
A natural boat ramp, you'd have an old slough coming off the river, and there'd be a place going into that slough. You just back up and unload your boat right there. And that old slough hit the river was high enough. And that's how you... unloaded your boat. If it wasn't, take about four of you.
You never had to ask permission from anybody,
no.
Anything.
Mm.
Just go and do
no,
it.
No.
Not till I was grown. Shoot, I guess I was.
There was a few of the people even leased land from W.T. Carter. They usually was some of their own hands. Authority that, you know, like Southwell leased that up there.
Yeah.
Like the Cold War. And, but man, oh man, that was a hot place for somebody to get shot for several years. But it was because he had leased some of Carter's land and made a pasture of it.
Gary, I remember one time that I was hunting, and I think Gerald and I were together, I believe that's right. It's so foggy in my mind. But we were going into there somewhere. We came up on a roadblock, and, Travis Wayne and LT, is that his brother, LT?
He had a brother named LT, yeah.
Okay.
Travis Little
Wayne
guy.
And LT and somebody else had put a roadblock across the road. And it was all over hunting rights. And do you remember anything about that?
I don't remember Travis Wayne's part of it. Don't remember how he figured in it. He was Travis's boy. Travis had four boys, I believe, Grover, Travis Wayne, LT, and Pee-wee. Charles, you know, the one I told you would come over here. And I don't remember him being anything but crossways with Southwell that had the pasture.
I guess that's what it was.
They might have been there, you know, tearing up his fence or something, but if I remember right, they was dead set against anything he did, you know.
Yeah.
The communities where y'all grew up, how many people, you know, you've described working the land, hunting, fishing, the crops that you had, kind of self-subsistence. How many people in the community would have worked, say, for the lumber companies in those communities? Either logging
or... Well, directly or indirectly.
What period of time it was?
Practically all of them, in one way or another.
Okay.
You know, you have people hauling, cutting, surveyors. You had everybody I know up and down that river was connected one way or the other, almost.
When they brought the grade in from Camden and crossed the river to the Angelina side, my grandpa, my daddy, great-grandpa, they was just
they did the great work and all that, yeah. On all that old
I had a great uncle that hunted and provided game for them. Rayburn.
Yeah.
Rayburn.
Yeah, he was their provisionary, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Okay.
think they crossed the river. That had been in the early to mid 20s, I think.
Yeah, Tyler County. They was
they
coming.
Came back again, though. What was it, in the 40s? They run that, redid that tram, the old Manning tram, and came back over here for the second time. Logged everything out and then left.
See, I never knew the difference in the trams, but the one coming from Manning down through Sayre was completely different from the one coming from the other side of the river on this side. And I never knew that until about 2 years ago. I just never connected it for some reason. I was talking to Berlin, and you know, he explained all of it to me and told me everything about it.
Well, the second time they came in, see, they didn't run the route from the mill because there was no mill. The mill burned, you know.
Yeah.
So everything was at Camden, so they were having to haul everything back to Camden.
Camden. And y'all know this, probably. The Manning Mill was the Carter-Kelley Lumber Company.
Right,
right.
It was joint ownership, and so Carter had the mill at Camden.
Right.
And so they kind of joined their operations, so, you know, some of the timber could go to Camden, some could go to Manning, and, you know, the river didn't separate them as before it did.
See, after I was born, there wasn't much of Manning left. And
I think it burned in 35,
uh-huh.
I believe. So that was 2 years before you
were born. 2 years before I was born. And so all I could get was just memories that Myron wrote about. And
well, that's what I was fixing to say. I remember Manning through memories with Myron. Because she wrote about it and made it so just like you would be there, you know. Dirty Street, Pumpkin Hill, and all them places.
Daddy said he drove out there one day to go to work. Now, see, he worked at Manning and had lived down on the river road, but he'd drive back and forth. So he said he and Woody Page, did you remember Woody? And Woody's Billy's daddy, and they were going out there, and Woody was working for Daddy. They found a body laying beside the road, and so Daddy thought Woody was a little bit young and he was going to have a little fun. He said, now Woody, he said, you don't drive and the law says one of us has got to go get the authorities and the other one's got to stay with the body, so you're going to stay with the body. And Woody was a little bit tongue-tied, you know. He called Daddy C.A. He said, T.A., he said, he doing all white before we die here. He be doing all white when we get back. He said, I ain't about to pay. And he did.
What happened to the fella?
Somebody killed him that night. It's a pretty rough place. It, just on the edge of Manning there. You can imagine like the edge of Houston in a smaller scale. But just as rough. Or worse, I guess.
Well, I had some kinfolks went to the pen. Of course, I never did know them. Because they robbed the commissary.
Oh.
And he went to the pen over.
The Manning commissary.
Yeah.
Yeah, it may have had more than once, but we've got some clippings on that.
Well, Leo Day, I think, was the one. Mm. I've been told this.
Now, the train was robbed, too, from Manning, the payroll train, wasn't it?
There's a lot of people
that'll
tell you today, still living, that'll tell you Quantrell's buried right here in Angelina County.
Well, out there close to Bald Hill somewhere.
I don't know where it is, but they swear this was his last.
See, I have a great-great-grandpa that supposedly rode the Quantrell. They said he would leave and be gone for months at a time and then come in. And nobody knew where he went. And maybe a month or two later, he would leave again, be gone for several months. And during that time frame, it was never proven, I don't think, and there's no way to prove it.
Well, when that rock outcrop that's down there by George Allen's camp house, you know the one I'm talking about?
The one where they...
the rock pressure?
Yeah.
Okay. There is a cave there, and there's a real prominent Havard engraved in that rock at the mouth of that cave there. I just wondered if you
know, I saw that in a book. It might have been your book. I don't know. But it was some book that I saw that in. And I've never seen that, actually. I didn't know it was there.
Yeah.
And which side of the river is it on?
It's on the Angelina County side.
Okay.
What was the other name? It was Havard and Oliver?
I don't remember, Jonathan.
Could have been.
I took a picture of it. We could look it up.
The Havard letters are that big. It's...
Well, I see.
Somebody put in some work doing that.
Well, now, was there a piece in the paper here a while back about that?
If it was, Jonathan put it in.
It was about Fort Sharan and where the original Fort Sharan, they said, was. It was on this side of the river instead of the other side.
No. The Fort Sharan is not where the marker is now.
Right.
Yeah. It was. Now, there's been a lot of written about it, and some people have suggested that it was on the Angelina County side, but I feel, and Donovan feels the same way, we're pretty sure we know where it was. It was on Tyler County side.
Okay.
Just below the mouth of Shawnee Creek. You know where the river does that? You know, here's Shawnee Creek coming down, and the river does this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And right there is where the fort was. That's where the old... Basically, there'd been a lot of research done on it, so we didn't really do anything groundbreaking in that sense. But I guess it was last summer that we wanted to try to find, you know, supposedly the fort was put where the old road crossing was. The road crossing was there because of the old Buffalo crossing. So knowing what we figured would be, need to, you know, surely there'd be indications along the riverbank, the river bottom. So the river was really low this summer. And so we found that place, and it kind of confirms some of the other sources. But, you know, in that bend there, that whole river bottom is hard rock. And it's got that gradual sloping bank on the Tyler County side. And so we think that's where the actual fort was.
Well, where is the buffalo skull?
Buffalo skull.
Something that article said a buffalo skull could still be seen. Yeah. I mean, that didn't make any sense to me.
Well, I didn't write anything about that, but now some of the legends were that the Mexicans had left gold in and around that area, you know, when they were fleeing. And some of the legends tell different markings, but crow's foot, you know, any type of markings and trees and rocks, and then you could use those points to triangulate where the gold was. And I know my conclusion was, if anybody found it, they're not saying.
No.
And I think Donovan has his own views. But I think, you know, Peter Ellis Bean, if y'all don't know if y'all are familiar
I've
with
heard
him.
Of.
But he was quite a character. He was the true entrepreneur, maybe even rascal, scoundrel, whatever you want to call
it. All of the above.
Yeah. he was an American by birth, but he was a colonel in the Mexican Army. And through several different turns of events, when Santa Ana came to power and then later when Texas got its independence, he was always on the winning side. But yet he still, anyway, he came out, he was in it for himself. And I think if there was any gold in anywhere near that area, because he was the commander of Fort Turan, he would have not only known about it, but he would have been the one to get it. And he lived till 1847, and so I think he would have had access to it. So I think it was just that. I think it's just stories.
Samuel Crane says, "Old man Fed Rigger got it." You remember Fed Rigger?
I've heard of Fed. That Fed got it. And I know some guys went up there to the Rodrigger place, and they was going to, what is those things you find money with?
Metal detector.
But they come back telling an awful ghost tale. They heard horses running, scared them half to death.
Did they see the horses or just hear them?
No, they just heard them. It was just a noise that they never did go back.
Cotton dug up $30,000 under their front porch when the old man died, or when he went to the hospital, I believe. They told him where it was, and Cotton went up there and dug it.
And got it up. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say. Well, you know, I've heard those old stories all my life. Now, J.R. Day Rayburn declares that there at that curve you was talking about a while ago, there was a cannon. Yeah, he saw it. Yeah, he was down there at the river.
I've heard that so many times.
But I mean,
you even went with somebody from Houston or Beaumont, and y'all
took them
scuba dived around there trying to find it.
But when it comes to a man, a man will lie to you. But I'm not saying Rayburn was lying.
He was a good fella.
He was just...
could have been mistaken.
Well, that's the story, too. You know, the gold rammed cannon, but that's common to a lot of places, not just here. But you know, supposedly the Mexicans were fleeing. There could have been two occasions. 1832 was one of the little rebellions. And that's when Santa Anna came to power, and all the Texans, the Anglo-Texans, were all having their own little problems with the Mexican government. Well, to get out of getting in trouble, they declared in favor of Santa Anna, so that got them off the hook for a few years. And, of course, Santa Anna then became the enemy shortly thereafter. But the facts are that, you know, the Mexicans had very little gold to start with.
Well, that's what
they were poorly paid. In fact, the Anglos were a lot better off than the Mexicans.
That was little Charlie Hybert's theory. He said, "Are y'all crazy?" He said, "Did nobody have no gold? We were so poor we couldn't pay attention."
I mean, what would they have been doing with it if they'd have had it?
Right. Well, then that's the thing. The records of Peter Ellis Mee and all of his papers and stuff, you know, they're in the archives in Mexico, and lots of other people have researched that. He's constantly writing. He was 2, 3, 4 years behind in getting paid himself. They just didn't have the money.
Nothing to pay with. Nobody had no gold.
No, and that's another thing too. You go back hundreds of years in time when Spain had it all. They all the gold went to Spain. It didn't stay here.
And you know yourself, if you knew about somebody burying some money, I'd have went back and got it, most likely. And I think the average person would.
Yeah.
But now, I know some old boys that came over here to Dabo to a fortune teller to find out where that money was. And I can tell you, I ain't going to call their names either to get me a lawsuit. But one of them told me about it finally after we was grown. And he said, the woman told him. She said, yeah. She said, it's over. And she said, there's a bunch of big old flat rocks. Well, shoot, they knew where that was at. And she said, one of them rocks had broke. It's at the end of that broke rock. Only strange thing I saw in the whole deal was what he told me, because I could see I had his confidence, and he was telling me the truth, I felt like. But how did she know where it was at? She was over here in Dabo, at 15 miles down there. And
why didn't she get it?
Well, she told him. She told me, said, one of y'all will bring your wife. I ain't going off a bunch of men. She said, if one of you bring your wife, I'll take you down there and show you where that money is. And this old boy said he went and got his wife. They went and got her, brought her down there. And then, of course, all them others was boogieing down there to see where the gold was. And they got to talking about it. Said, now, you don't go all the way to those rocks. You stop on this side about 250 yards or 300 yards. So that's what he did, said he pulled up there and he said it was just like she read ever thought he had. Said she hit that road, went down that road, they followed her right down there. She said, there it is, now take me back to Dabo. And she went back, they took her back. Of course, they didn't find the money. But he said when he got back that his brothers, that's where all that wild tail and Sarah got started. Whenever they got back, they couldn't get their boys to go back down there. They said they heard horses, they heard noises, they heard all mannerisms of spooky stuff.
This is broad daylight.
Broad daylight. So they'd never go back to
but
that
But they place. Heard enough to scare them off.
And they managed to not ever go back, to my knowledge. That scared, took care of all their money hunting right there.
Now, we never heard any horses, did we?
They didn't.
Yeah, but y'all probably didn't go to the money hole.
We probably weren't in the right
place. We weren't close to the money. But we were at those flat rocks.
Yeah, we went all over the place. We were in all
Well, he said they thought enough about it. They come back over here and asked the woman, said, why couldn't we find the money? She said, you had a man with you, wasn't supposed to be with you.
Oh.
What she told
Explains all that.
Explains it all right there.
Yes, it does.
Can you tell me how the rocks down at the Rocky Ford got formed?
Now, which Rocky Ford?
You go to Sayre and
the crossing?
Yeah, Shawnee Creek.
Yeah.
Oh, Shawnee Creek. Shawnee Creek Rocky Ford. Okay,
yeah,
where the piling used to go through there.
Yeah, where it looks like the rocks are cut.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's that Catahoula Rock. I'm guessing it's what that is through there, I don't know, but I'm sure that's part of the Catahoula Formation through there. And that thing is, those rocks, as you know, have got sharp edges in there. So, but beyond that, I can't tell you.
It's all sandstone.
It looks like they were cut and set.
Yeah.
Which I know they weren't.
Yeah. But you see that those, that sandstone was formed in blocks like that. You'd see it everywhere. You
yeah.
go around the blue hole over there and used to cut, and you could see where those blocks had those fissures down through there, you know. And that's the only explanation I can give.
But after watching all those old bricks up at Nacogdoches for all these years, and they look like they've stayed right there, just like they were put years ago, you yeah. know. Somebody could have put those in there, Winnie.
Did y'all ever go to the blue hole?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I yes, swim down there all the time.
And the clay pit's what we like better.
No, that's over Angelina County. Uh-huh. So, yeah.
Yeah, the blue hole got to where the college kids was coming down and messing it up. When I was younger, all of us kids from Ramsville and Sayre would go to the blue hole.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we had, there's one great big huge rock up there that we'd stand on, had a rope tied to, I believe it was a big sweet gum tree. Swing out there. I never would climb up in a sweet gum tree and dive out, though.
Well, I know we bored y'all this morning.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed it. Y'all care to add anything?
See, I couldn't document a thing except I've been digging that hole in the river.
Well, y'all didn't talk about logging anyway. Are you, either one of you familiar with the old logging they used to do, the bobtail truck logging and loading with horses and mules? And
yeah, see, in our time, though, it was bobtail trucks and loaders, wasn't it? Loading with mules and...
Is that mostly pulpwood? Pulpwood y'all were loading?
Long, long logs, too. They'd load them on those trucks with... It was funny how you talk about evolution. Now, that surely would have to be considered an evolvement because it just got to work today, you know, with nothing but 18-wheelers. And it was nothing then but bobtail trucks and dangerous. Oh. Whew, so much danger there. And it was just a rough, hard work, boy.
Yeah, I can remember the tail end of that. Because, like I said, I'm 10 years older than them, or younger than them. So I can remember them hauling on the short trucks. And you'd see somebody with muscles like that and say he's a pupwooder. Because, you know, small wood, they'd just take and throw it up on the bed of the truck.
But, you know, you remember to look back on it with 2020s, you know, looking back. But anyway, all of a sudden somebody wanted to haul more, you got a drag axle. You remember that?
Yeah.
And the first thing you know, you got two. Well, actually, the drag axle doesn't touch the ground unless he's loaded, you know. And it helps him to haul more. And they just get those loads higher and higher and higher. But then, you know, of course, the long logs become the thing of the day on those. When did that come, Andy? I can't remember, man.
Oh, that was owned up in... Kit Crane was hauling with a log truck.
He had, I believe, one of the first ones I remember.
Yeah, me too. I guess he was hauling with it in the 60s, probably, maybe. In the 50s, he was hauling with it in the 50s. He had a log truck in the 50s, a trailer. Sure did. Yeah.
They had an old boy from over to, on the other side of the river, what we was talking about a while ago with Polk County. Camden, that was an Indian, and he never had a dent in his truck, and he was always so slow and precise, you know, that one day I remember some of them was bragging, you know, about the old fella, how he was, truck just like a new truck, boy, all the time, but I remember he said, I take no chance, couldn't say chance, mm-hmm. He said it like any chance, he said, it wasn't 2 months till he got killed. I got a log on it, but that was a dangerous thing, man.
Yeah.
Were there any mills in there around Sayre and y'all?
Yeah, Carl Walker, you know, had a mill.
Well, Nat Barkin had
one. Nat Barkin had a mill, and different ones.
Are these like groundhog mills or the portable mills? Or stationary meals.
Pecker windmill. They were yeah. Stationary, but
stationary, but still on a small scale, you know, and also dangerous, boy.
Yeah. And that's how Knapp built his house.
Mm-hmm.
He went down and pulled all the cypress that he could find out of the Neches River.
And
yeah, a lot of people don't know that's a cypress house.
Yeah,
now,
made boards out of it and built it.
Well, fellas, I sure appreciate it. Hey, I think we've been going for a couple hours now, time flies when you're
having fun.
If you
really want to know something, ask Berlin and Charles.
Havard?
Yeah, they would be good interviews. They sure would.
Berlin would be real good. And Linwood might be.
You couldn't believe Linwood.
Linwood being you both whenever they saw us. We'd have 5D.
I would have to be here for that interview. Linwood Dykes. Joe Dykes, his son.
Yeah, I know Linwood.
He knows Linwood well.
Well, Linwood and Berlin and Pee-wee would be good.
All right, I'll go ahead and stop this now. And again, thank y'all.
Thank you.